This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Hello, everybody. Here, Baseball Outside. My name is John McLaren. If you're watching on YouTube, you're going to see him live. Also on Facebook Live, we've got you. If you got any questions, just up at the bottom. Who you're seeing right now is John, and I am your host, Pete Caliendo. Listen, we're glad that you joined us here in the U.S. and around the world. We're going to have another great show. First of all, let me tell you quickly, we got a lifer. This is a baseball lifer, man. He's done everything in the game, managing the big leagues, coached in the big leagues. We'll talk about some of that. He was a World Baseball Classic USA coach, a third base coach. He scouted. He was actually the seventh round pick as a catcher. He's managed the China team for the World Baseball Classic. I mean, we could keep going on. He's traveled all over the world. Folks, I want to thank on behalf of the International Sports Group. You all know what we do. We train coaches all over the world as best we can. And John is one of our instructors also. So thanks for going overseas, because they certainly doesn't do it for the money, because nobody really gets much. So I want to welcome John McLaren. What's up, John, in beautiful Florida?
Pete, it's great to be here with you. I follow you on Facebook. You do a great job. And, you know, I've gone a couple of neat places because of you. I've gone to Ireland and I've gone to Belarus. And I love spreading the word of baseball. And you do a good job of it. And I'm glad to be involved.
Well, I'll tell you what, you've been a lot of places. But the years that you've been in the game, you know, you're a great example, somebody who started in the minor leagues and put in a lot of time. So one thing I'd love to do, since, you know, off the top of my head, I just thought about this. I'm thinking, you know, there's a lot of coaches out there. You're seeing more and more young coaches get into pro ball, you know, but, you know, you also have to put in your time a little bit. Maybe explain a little bit some advice you give to some younger coaches if they do want to get into pro ball, especially nowadays. What's a great way to do that?
Well, Pete, when I signed in 1970 with the Astros, I thought it was going to be a matter of time and I'd be in the big leagues and I was going to have a long major league career. And I found out there was players a lot better than me that were out there. And I got up to AAA and I could tell I wasn't going to be a major league player on any regular basis, maybe a cup of coffee. But right then I changed my focus and said, there's other ways of getting to the big leagues. And Pat Gillick approached me about joining the Toronto Blue Jays. And the first people he hired in November 1st of 1976. And, wow. I started off scouting for 4 years and managing the rookie team. And I just always kind of told Pat, I said, Pat, I'd like to be a major league coach at some point, whatever I have to do. And I think by scouting amateurs, high school and college, and besides seeing some guys, you know, like Ozzie Smith at Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, you know, I mean, it was cool. So some of these guys from before they made it, and it gave me a background how to project. And I think that's one thing that I had to offer for Lou Piniella, is because, you know, Lou Piniella was in the big leagues, I don't know, 35 years. And mm-hmm. he it was hard for him to see a young the best example I can give is Lloyd Mosby. He was the number one draft pick of Toronto in 1978, made himself an all-star in the big leagues. When I had him in 1978 in rookie league in Medicine Hat, Alberta, Canada, we were changing positions, putting him in the outfield, and he couldn't throw the ball from left field to the cutoff, how weak his arm was. And then to see him develop to have an above average arm from center field, it was unbelievable. And some players take more times than others. And You know, we're sitting here talking about, and my mind races about some of the things that I have seen. And I just like to run this story by you just to show you how people come late in their careers. In 1980, my last year scouting for Toronto, I was in Houston, Texas. And I went to see Springwoods High School play about seven times. So number one pitcher on the team was Rick Lucan, who went to Texas A&M, was a number one draft pick, pitched in the big leagues. Number two pitcher on the team was Reiner Noble, who ended up coaching University of Houston about 10 years. Yeah. And the number three guy was a fat first baseman, third baseman, that I never saw a pitch one time. His name was Roger Clemens. And I like to tell this story is because this guy came late. This guy, he started the Carl Young College League that summer out of high school. He lost weight. He picked up velocity. He went to Wayne Graham at San Jacinto Junior College, and then he went to University of Texas. And to me, he's one of the greatest pitchers of all time. And I had the good fortune of getting to coach him one year in 1991 in Boston. And just to see him, you know, actually not being thought of at all, no scholarships or anything. And then this summer league that he played in, he started to develop. And I think that's one thing that I've learned, especially doing all the academies that I've done with Major League Baseball in Europe and my work with China, is they're so far behind the curve that you have to have patience. And it's not an overnight process. And it's going to take longer for them to develop. You know, when they first come over here to a new country, like guys that signed from Italy and Germany and these countries, Holland, I mean, they have good programs over there. And they're like our young Dominican players, that you have to be patient with them, and there's going to be a lot of failure. And as our jobs as coaches, we have to encourage them, pick them up, and keep building them. And I'm sure we got hundreds of stories of guys that have been in baseball with stories like Roger Clemens and guys that have, you know, have just persevered and become really good players.
And John, what's throughout your career, what's the difference now when you're coaching, managing, whether it be a professional player or whether it be an international player? What are some of the differences on how you handle players compared to maybe how you used to handle them in the past? There's got to be some differences.
That's good. Nowadays. That's a good question, Pete. When I first started coaching, I wanted to be liked. You know, I'm a Texan. I'm a good old boy. And, you know, I wanted everybody to like me. And as I got experience and confidence comes with it. And, it was more about getting the players to respect you, to teach them the right things. And the friendship will come after that. And I think all young players need and want discipline. They act like they don't, but I really think they do. And I think it's our jobs. And I'm not talking about being an Army sergeant. I'm talking about somebody that gives them good guidance and good advice. And, this is what players are looking for. This is what we have to do as coaches. And, as I got experience as a coach and, I tried to share some of my experiences and, I always tell the story about Alex Rodriguez. I was actually communicating with this high school coach on Facebook last night, or Rich Hoffman.
Rich Hoffman.
I think
sure.
A lot of Rich, yep. Good man. And I always tell the story that as a young player, Alex asked more questions about players before him than any player I ever had. And I really think that he respected the game. And, not into getting into great detail about Alex Rodriguez and all that kind of stuff. But I think when he left Seattle, he left his mentors and, things started going a different direction. But I just marvel at his talent, to see him the way he came as a dead pull hitter out of high school. and Leo, you're working him and staying inside the ball and shooting it the other way. And getting to watch him on a daily basis for years was, it was great, you know, him and Griffey and Buhner and all the guys I've gotten to see. It's just, you know, it's just made the job even more worthwhile.
John, nowadays you're starting to see a shift in the game a little bit. I think it's pretty good because when I grew up, for me, never played in, you know, professional baseball or in the big leagues. Very difficult for me to hook up with a major league organization when it comes to coaching. When it comes to scouting, that wasn't as difficult. Nowadays, you got some young players or young coaches who don't have, never played in the big leagues, never yes. even, some possibly didn't play in pro ball.
Yes.
Some advice if when they get into it, because, you know, it can't be easy. I remember my first time independent ball, I was a little bit intimidated when Jay Ward asked me, hey, come coach with me. I'm like, well, I never coached pro guys before. You know, I've coached Team USA, but never pro guys. And so some advice on how do you handle these guys? Are they different or, you know, what's some advice you can give some coaches getting in the pro ball?
Well, I think my best advice, Pete, is being honest, being straight up with them. And, you know, I've done a couple baseball coaches conventions here recently. And I tell these coaches, sometimes when you're asked questions, you're not sure about them. I wouldn't fake it. I would. There's times. I mean, I've been asked questions, and it's like someone asked me about infield play. That wasn't my strength. I wasn't an infielder. I was a catcher.
Catcher. Yeah.
And what I would do, I would call Sammy Palazzo, a friend of mine who's a great infield coach, and ask him questions, you know, I mean, and then get back to him, you know.
Sure.
You know, I think when you try to act like you know the game and you're not really sure about something, you know, your credibilities can take a hit when, you know, maybe something comes out and you try to, you know, dance your way through it. But, you know, I've always said it, I encourage players to ask questions.
Yeah.
I think a lot of kids are a little shy and they feel like they might be embarrassed if they ask something. And I remember one year Edgar Martinez came into camp with us with Seattle, and I was managing the Mariners, and we had him talk to our minor league players. And I can remember it like yesterday. And so Edgar talked a little bit about hitting, and he had to be him and Wade Boggs. I mean, they were just terrific hitters. And I said, does anybody have any questions? And Brian O'Hare raised his hand up. And he says, Edgar, what was the toughest pitch for you to hit? He said, oh, it was definitely the hard sinker. He says, it was a difficult pitch because if I tried to do too much with it, you know, I'd foul it off my foot or I'd pull it foul. And then Brian raises his hand again. He says, well, how did you hit that? He says, I'd usually try to hit a single through the middle and get an RBI and cut back, then try to go for a double or a home run and overswing. And it was just great advice. And I thought the question was fabulous by Brian. And I thought that Edgar's answer was just right on. And, you know, I just think sharing information, you know, when that's one thing I miss is when you're in the coach's room. And I mean, I think that, you know, we'd be sitting in there and it'd be Bob McClure and Larry Boa and Steve Henderson and Juan Samuel and just all the coaches over the years. And we, you know, they just tell stories and Mike Schmidt would walk in and Gary Matthews. And they would just talking baseball and sharing experiences and, you know, some guys struggling and, you know, hearing other guys' opinions that's not around the team every day. And I just think sharing information about baseball, you know, it goes a long way. And that's why I like your situation here is you can share information with coaches that don't have a chance to, you know, listen to different opinions.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm thinking, I believe you were a bench coach also with Major League Club. It'd be interesting for our audience, our coaches, you know, because you have your manager and at any level, college, high school, you also have an assistant coach. Kind of interesting to discuss, you know, some of the what your responsibility was as a bench coach and how that how you communicated that with the manager.
Yeah. Well, I had the honor of coaching for Lou Piniella for 14 years.
Oh, yeah.
And, he's one of the best. He's a Hall of Famer for me. I think he'll get in. And Lou was one of the smartest guys I've ever been around. I mean, he was smart. And, you know, some people look at him and, you know, because he'd get on the umpires every now and then, they'd think that, you know, that he'd go, you know, go off the deep end sometimes. And, you know, that, he, you know, he'd be, you know, he was just a you know, just a guy. He was a very intelligent man. He was a numbers guy. I mean, we did numbers way before numbers.
Back then, wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we did numbers. And there are different type of numbers, but we did numbers. And Lou would ask me his favorite line. All the players used to kid me, what would you do here, Mac? And I would tell him, and he would either reaffirm what he was thinking or it would make him think a different angle. And I would try to do it. And so if he didn't ask me, I would suggest something early. And it would give him time to digest it. So it wasn't a spontaneous decision. It was something that it was well thought out. And I'm laughing because I always tell this story. We're in Seattle one night. And as you hear, Mac, and I told him what I'd like to do, you know, and we did it. It didn't work. And about two innings later, he's saying, oh, I can't believe we did that. What a dumb move that was, you know. So I you know, I took it. I was part of it. But, you know, I mean, I was cool about it. So the next night, Lou comes up and he says, what are you going to do here, Mac? And I looked at him. I said, you know, Lou, you make $3 million a year. You make the call. And I walked off. And he came over and gave me a big bear hug. And he said, that's why I love you, man. He says, because you're a straight up guy. But I love my association with Lou Piniella. You know, he was a really good player. And, you know, some of his stories he had about Yogi Berra and George Steinbrenner, I would try to ask him to talk about these guys when he wasn't in a good mood to loosen him up. But he had some great stories. I mean, you know, that's what the game's about is just, you know, I used to talk to Don Zimmer in the clubhouse in Tampa Bay. Some of the stories he had about Johnny Padres and Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson. I mean, I was all ears, man. I mean, it was just it didn't get any better than that. The train rides and, you know, the different era of baseball, just like we have today. And
sure.
He told me he hit and ran with the bases loaded three times. And I'm, you know, you think about that, you know, that's out of the box.
Yeah, it is.
I said, why, Don? He says, because I knew he was going to put the bat on the ball and he wasn't going to strike out and we weren't going to hit into a double play. And you think about it, it made some sense.
Yeah, it makes.
I never did it.
Things move.
I never did it, but it was great just having these conversations.
You know, you talk about outside the box. What were some of the things as a manager at any level that you've done that you were outside of the box that normally you wouldn't do in baseball? Because it's kind of, you know, it's the manager has that prerogative. I mean, he thinks if something's going to work, you know, there's not really a book to follow all the time.
Yeah. That's a good question. You know, the not involving myself, but I remember the time that Buck Showalter intentionally walked Barry Bonds with the bases loaded.
Sure.
And in the game, he put the winning run at second base or whatever, but it worked. But his answer was, he says, we couldn't get Barry Bonds out, and I wasn't gonna try. And you know, those are type of things right there out of the box. And you know, I think out of the box thinking is good, and it brings fresh ideas. And I not so much maybe what you're thinking about. It might bring up different ideas. pertaining to another situation. But, you know, I've always encouraged coaches that when they have a thought to bring it up and to share the ideas. I mean, that's how you get things. I love the thought of debate. I think debate brings positive things done in a constructive way. And, you know, as long as you're not throwing somebody under the bus, you know, I think debates, we used to have that in the old days with the Toronto Blue Jays with Bobby Maddox. I mean, he was a terrific baseball guy and he challenged you. He wanted to see what you're all about. And, you know, he would bring up, questions, and he would see the guys that would speak up, in which he was kind of testing us in his own way. And he was a great teacher. I got a lot of Bobby Maddox instilled in me.
So after ball games, when you were a manager, after ball games, would you get together with your coaching staff and then review what happened in the game and have an open conversation?
Every night. Jim Riggleman will always come in the office after the game and see how I was doing. And I would do the same thing when I coached for him in Washington. I was his bench coach. And we would talk about moves and what we could have done different. And, it was the type of thing where, you know, as myself as a bench coach, the manager could vent, the manager could, second guess himself, and I could give my opinion on it and maybe how we could do it different next time in a constructive way or whatever. But I always like the coaches coming in and we talk about the game, positive and negative, you know what I mean? The things that went right and things we could improve on. And what I'm thinking about it? I got notes here in front of me, and I'm a note guy. Uh-huh. And I've always told coaches, I said, during the game, have a notepad or have a pen, and on your lineup card, write things during the game, things that you need to work on, things that, you need to bring up later on. And, sometimes you forget things. And it's the same thing with workouts. Like in spring training, I would coordinate spring training and I would have the workout sheet. And during the workout, I would write myself notes for the next time we did this drill or the next spring training. I would have the notes from the year before and say, you know, we didn't have enough time on this, or we need to work on this more. And during the year, I would take notes for things that we need to do in spring training, sometimes I forget things like everybody. So when you have notes and you can reflect back and, you'll be ready for the next time.
Excellent. Love it. And, John, managing, everything happens so fast. I mean, things, you don't have a lot of time to think. And obviously, you've got your bench coach and you got some coaches to bounce things off of. Kind of the thought process every at bat, every inning, what are you thinking most of the time? What should a coach or manager be thinking about? Because that's not an easy thing to do.
No, I mean, you depend on all your coach, especially your pitching coach, I used to remind Lou and, I say, they got a left-hander coming up next inning, maybe we need to have somebody ready or we're getting deep in the game and their best hitter is a left-hander. And I said, you know what, maybe we can just deke them and have this guy warming up and, maybe they won't use him in this situation. And then we can get to our closer and it'd save us one move. And so, the pitching coach, I had Mel Stottlemyre and he was the best, I'd ask him a couple times. I said, well, what do you want to do here? He says, flip a coin. There's certain times when you've pressed your bullpen and you've overworked a lot of guys. And, just thinking about how you use pitching is, I think the one time, the few times, you know, you have a game where, let's say, you're losing 4-2 and you've used your good pitcher 2 days in a row, and you say, now, do I want to bring him and keep the game where it is now, or can, you know, we expand somebody else's role, and we can save this guy for the next tomorrow night when he'll mm-hmm. be fresh and we're winning the game. And I think those are big decisions every night, you know, when you're losing 2-1 and you use your closer and he's got to throw 30 pitches the next night, you're winning by a run and he used 30 something pitches the night before and pitched 2 days in a row before that. I mean, there's a lot of balance in that out there. And today we match up more than we ever have. I mean, sure. Starters don't go near as deep into the games. We have bullpen guys that start games now. I mean, this is where the game has changed greatly. And we met, I mean, in September, I mean, I can remember some games. There was 13 to 14 pitchers in a game from one team. And you just, it's crazy. It's just, you know, you match up every hitter late in the game. And, you know, they're talking about this new rule. Now you got to go three hitters. So it's going to be interesting how this starts unfolding a little bit. You know, this is the changing of the game. And, you know, we had talked earlier, you know, before I came on, how's the game, you know, kind of changed over the years?
And, that's a big question.
The shifts is a huge thing. You know, you have, you know, we always used to have defensive charts. I used to have the starting pitcher tell me where he'd wanted his infield, especially to be positioned. Mm. And, the younger pitchers, we just go completely off the charts. But, you know, when you had a Randy Johnson or a Chris Bosio or Jamie Moyer, they liked certain things, you know, third baseman closer to the line, shortstop over in the hole, whatever. And so you would let them kind of dictate how they wanted their defense. And, you know, there's some pitchers now, you can see them visibly upset when they have the shifts.
Yes.
Verlander comes to mind right off the top of my head.
Absolutely.
You know, he just kind of looks in the dugout like, really?
Yeah.
Well, it's just, if you had a regular defense, you know, he's out, you know. Yeah. But, you know, this new, you know, the amount of work that's put in, there's such a team behind the scenes, Pete, that the teams have, you know, and they're smart guys. I mean, I used to love it. Larry and Bo and I used to talk old school baseball with this guy, and he liked it. You know, we were just trying to get him to think how we thought in the old days. And he's telling us nowadays. And a lot of teams make the lineup out and it's on the manager's desk. Mm-hmm. That never happened in years past. I mean, you used to always, that was one of the privileges of being a manager. You make your own lineup out. But, you know, a lot of teams, they have rest. And players, I can remember one time there was, I'm not going to name the player of the team because I won't embarrass anybody, but this guy was like 9-for-17 off our starting pitcher. And it's kind of like, wow. So we happened to, went after practice and the manager came over and was talking to myself, another one of the coaches. And he says, how about that? He says, team says this is his rest day today and he's 9-for-17 off your pitcher. But I mean, rest is, you know, they're like spring training. They're starting workouts maybe an hour and a half later than we used to in the old days, so they can get their rest. And you know, it's just, you know, it's part of the new school of thinking. And
sure.
You know, talking about how you handle pitching now, very rarely do you see a starter go three times through the lineup unless he is a Verlander or one of your Kershaw or one of your top guys. They said that's enough. You don't want him to go for the third time. And you go to your closer. I mean, you go to your closer in the seventh inning sometimes now because, you know, they think that's where the game is. And,
sure.
You know, that's you know, part of it. And home runs. I mean, that's a huge part of our game. You know, you don't see as much hitting and running. You don't see as much bunting. You don't see as much stealing. what would our guy Louis Aparicio do these days, Pete? I mean, yeah, exactly. Go Sox, you know.
Well, you know, that scares you. You know, what scares me just a little bit is what you're hearing a lot. And matter of fact, since you mentioned it, what you're hearing a lot is at the younger levels. Now, I'm not saying everybody, but you're starting to hear it. And that worries me. They're starting to get in the way from teaching bunting. You know, and I'm thinking, I mean, completely. Yeah, yeah. You know, why even? Yeah. Because at the higher levels, problem is not everybody's going to play at the higher levels. So why can't we still keep the bunting game going at the younger levels?
I think it's a great point. I think you teach everybody how to play the game, and then when you work your way up the ladder, whatever system you got in place, but at least you know how to do it. If you don't know how to do it, and there's another decision. I mean, I've been through this, and I've had this debate with Lou Piniella. You got a bunt situation, a really weak hitter against their closer in the ninth inning. And let's just say you got a guy that doesn't know how to bunt. What do you do?
You're stuck.
Do you still force him to bunt, or you to pinch hit him and make him bunt? We've had this discussion, I mean, a long time. To me, if the situation called for a bunt and this guy's a strikeout hitter and you want to move the runners, you pinch hit the guy even if it is to bunt. I mean, I have no problem with that. You know, a lot of people say, you know, you're out of touch. And I say, well, I'm out of touch, but that's what I would do because that's what the situation calls.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I'll tell you what, the other thing is great managers love to know this. There's so much to the game. You can't know everything. But the great managers, where were the majority of their strengths? Why were they so good? What were they good at? Because you can't be good at everything.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the things that you have to be as a good coach and a manager, and those are strengths and weaknesses of your players, and try to put them in situations where they have a chance to succeed. I mean, I can remember really some matchups, you know, like you don't want to pinch hit for your regular everyday players, but you look at the matchup, 0 for 18 with 14 strikeouts. I mean, today, sometimes you pinch hit for those guys. Mm-hmm. You know, the game's changed a little bit, and some of the players don't like it, and you bruise egos a little bit. But you know, that's just part of the game today. I mean, the one thing I don't like today is I don't think you should accept strikeouts. You know, when you have a guy that has power, there's no reason why he can't cut down with two strikes. And, you know, they say an out's an out. Well, I don't believe that. I think when you put the ball in play, a lot of things can happen. You know, wild throws, errors, whatever. And I'm not talking about asking a power guy to be a punch and duty. I'm just talking about have a two-strike approach where you get closer to the plate, cut down the angle on the breaking ball, try to shoot the ball the other way. And I think one of my biggest pet peeves is a non-power guy that can't break a shift. I really have a problem with that. Yeah. You know, when a guy is not a power hitter, there's no reason why that he can't beat the shift. I really believe that. He's a major league hitter. And when a non-power guy is trying to hit into a dead pull shift, I just shake my head like this can't be.
Question for that. Is that something you have to develop, you know, in spring training, or you have to develop early on, or can you think you could just turn it on or off?
No, I think you got it's a teaching tool. I think, you know, to go the other way. Like I said, I saw Alex Rodriguez when he came from high school. He was an absolute extreme dead pull hitter. I mean, he hit balls so far down a third baseline and up in the stands.
Yeah.
And that's the way it was. You turned on the ball. And he learned to have better balance and stay back and keep his hands inside the ball and let the ball get a little bit deeper on him with two strikes. And, you know, guys, again, non-power guys, there's no reason why you can't choke. Get close to the plate, choke up on the bat, and shoot the ball the other way. When I used to set the defensive in the old days, One guy I can think of is Pudge Rodriguez. He was a great hitter. Oh, my goodness. Pudge was a great hitter. He had power, and his ability was to go the other way. And I told Lou Piniella one day, I said, Lou, I'm on two strikes. I'm going to play him almost like a left-hand pull hitter. And Lou looked at me. I said, you know, he's looking at me. I said, are you serious? I said, I'm dead serious. I said, this hitting chart, he just shoots the ball. He just takes his single and gets the RBI. And I can remember the first time we did it, I could see in his eyes, he could notice that the second baseman was playing him over. And the other guy that could use that was Cal Ripken Jr. Cal Ripken Jr. had great bat control. I mean, I can't tell you how many hits. He just takes the single to right field and get the RBI with two strikes. And just a sign of somebody using his talent. And he did that.
And I got to believe, because as I look back at the World Series, a few World Series, I got to believe, because I'm looking at some teams that the ones that won the World Series last two or three were teams that were hitting the ball in different areas. They could hit the gaps in different areas, pitch, you know, hit away. I got to believe that cycle is going to come around, because people are going to wake up, say, look, I just can't win with just only guys that are going to hit home runs.
Well, I used to keep the hitting chart on the bench. What we used to do in Toronto in the old days, I'd have different colored pins for each pitcher. So we had some history, because we played a balanced schedule. So we played teams a lot. So we had more history. And Paul Molitor and Robin Yount, from one line to the other. I mean, yeah. It's like you had to play them straight. I mean, and then you had a guy, Don Baylor, was an extreme pull hitter. And, you know, you could play accordingly. And with somebody like Yount and Molitor and Cal Ripken Jr., I mean, they just, wherever the ball was pitched, they'd hit. And it's, you know, it's hard to pitch to them. It's hard to put a defense on them, because they were adjusting to the pitcher and looking for pitches and setting pitchers up. And, you know, I'm not saying there's not gamesmanship today. Of course there is. But to see these guys operate, it was really watching a real skilled guys at work.
Folks, you might be seeing me looking over to my left a little bit. That's Facebook Live I'm looking at, because we got some questions from our friends from Belarus. This is not an easy question, because the question came up from Dimitri, our friend Dimitri, and John's been to Belarus.
Loved it. I tell you what, I enjoyed my time in Belarus. Great people, and I respect him for wanting to play baseball.
Well, this is not, I don't think this is going to be an easy question from the standpoint that, but the question is, utilizing statistics, whether it be when you were managing or now, and the hunch, you know, using your gut instincts.
Yes.
How easy, yeah. I mean, how, you know, as can you teach that? I mean, is it just experience?
Yeah, well, I think when you have numbers in front of you, it changes your hunch. It doesn't change your hunch, but it reaffirms it, you know. When you have a gut feeling, a lot of times numbers can be misleading, Pete, and I'll tell you why. Is like we got this stats on the pitchers against their hitters. Well, these hitters might have been the front part of their career, and they might have hit this pitcher earlier in his career where later they haven't. And so it might change it up a little bit. But if you've got a pitcher out there that's absolutely dealing, I think you really got to weigh on what your guy's doing right then, you know, whether you want to pitch to this guy or that guy. And, you know, numbers don't lie. Like I said, they're doing numbers now more than ever. And, you know, it should either reaffirm what you think or make you think more. Well, God, maybe I should do it this way, because these numbers, you know, they're so overwhelming. Why wouldn't I do that? You know,
sure.
I do. Let me just clarify. I do think the gut is still a big game.
Yes.
I do believe that.
Good to hear that. Hey, you also hear this a lot, and you've talked about quite a bit about pitching, but you've also said, you know, to be a good manager at any level, you got to be able to handle the pitching staff. You know, I know you got a pitching coach, but you're the guy who's going to make the final decision.
Yeah.
Give some advice on, you know, handling a pitching staff. I know it could be a topic of its own, but some advice that you would give coaches on how to handle pitching staff, some things they need to do.
Well, I think as you, as the game goes on, if you start seeing the pitcher starting to lose velocity, you start seeing him getting underneath his pitches. He's not finishing his pitches. I think it's a red flag that he's starting to tire. He doesn't have his control. He wasn't as sharp he was in the front part of the game. He's throwing more pitches per batter, per inning, and his pitching count's getting up. And so he's starting to tell you that it's time. And, you know, you can look at him breathing sometimes, you know, and, you know, there's stressful innings too, you know. I mean, you see him like the inning before someone took a 10 pitch at bat, you know. I mean, he's not executing his pitches, and this was high maintenance. I mean, he had to work to get this one hitter, and that's where good hitting comes in, where you can, you know, the great hitters can foul pitches off, and you know, you start getting that pitch count up, and it works in your favor. So you know, those are things that you look for, and you know his history. You know, how many pitches did he throw his start before? Did he have a lot of pitches? You know, if he had a low pitch count, maybe he can go a little bit further this time out. Or if he had a real high pitch count, you say, you know what, I can't press him. I can't be putting that many pitches on him. Because he's going to, you know, you're going to end up hurting a kid. And, you know, that's another subject, you know. I mean, in the youth, there's so much travel ball. There's so much, you know, select baseball. And I go out to these tournaments. I have friends that coach these. And I go out here in Peoria, and I'll go watch some games. And what happens is one kid will go from one team to the other just because he wants to play. He loves the game. I mean, I would. Many games I could play, I'd want to. Now, the problem is when you play a heavy schedule like some of these select teams, you run out of pitching. So you ask for volunteers.
Yeah.
And this kid is a gamer. This guy, I mean, he's a Banty Rooster. He comes to play, and he's a team player. And he says, yeah, I'll pitch. Well, he pitched the day before. No one knew you know, and if someone doesn't look out for this kid, I really think a lot of young stress on a young arm can be so harmful. And as us as coaches, we have to look out for this. We have to look out.
And that was going to be my next question. And that is, you know, at the big league level, you don't see guys thrown 3 days in a row, you know, relievers. But yet sometimes at the younger levels, you see that. I mean, that's pretty dangerous. You know, how did you judge that? I mean, that's a lot.
Well, these kids are, their arm has not developed yet. And a lot of my friends, I mean, they relive their careers through their sons. You know, I mean, it's a natural thing.
Sure.
And, you know, what I tell them is, I said, don't put such pressure on them to succeed that they don't enjoy playing the game. And, you know, you've got to look at him as a parent, you know. I mean, there's nothing wrong as a parent going up to coach, say, you know what, he threw a lot of pitches last time out. I really think we should watch the pitch count. His arm is a little tender. And, you know, one thing I like to tell young coaches, when there's a soreness, you can play catch and you can work a little soreness out. But if there's a sharp pain, there's something there. That's when you need to shut it down right then and get somebody that knows what they're doing to look at it. When there's continuous sharp pain, there's a problem inside there. And you got to know the difference between a stiffness and just, you know, something that you can, you know, just play catch and work out. If they're, you know, I always tell kids, I said, look, if you keep having arm problems, and you know, you can tell the way kids throw, Pete. You can tell that they're cutting themselves off. If they're not getting a good extension, they're not getting on top of the ball. You can read this as a coach. Mm-hmm. And these are telling signs that there might be a big problem and you need to shut a kid down.
And John, sometimes I remember even in pro ball, you may not have enough pitching, and that day you might have to lose that game to win the battle later. Is that
absolutely? Absolutely. Yeah, there's no question about that, you know. And you hurt your arm young, it's hard to rebound. You know, when you have to have surgery at a real young age, it's, and especially if someone has the potential to have a great arm. You know, I was reading yesterday, talking about, Syndergaard, actually. I mean, this guy was a beast. I mean, I saw this kid when he was in AAA when I was scouting, and it's as good a report I ever wrote on a pitcher. I mean, this guy was an absolute beast. And here he's going to have Tommy John. And he's a max effort guy almost every single pitch. Mm-hmm. And there's something to be said about that, you know, when to back off. And I'm not talking about taking 8 miles an hour off or something like that, but you don't need to be max effort every single pitch. I mean, it's you know, and, you know, it's like young kids at a young age. I mean, young kids can't hit a breaking ball when they're young. And you got a young kid that can throw a good breaking ball, and he throws every pitch breaking ball. And his shoulders is not developed enough to throw a breaking ball time after time after time again. So, again, this is where us as coaches have to come in and say, look, we want you to command your fastball. We want you to use your fastball to develop your fastball. You might get hit in this game, but in the future, you're going to be a better pitcher. And, you know, these kids need this guidance. I mean, they're always going to go to the well because they know they can strike the guy out. And if we don't help them, you're going to create problems for a young pitcher's arm.
Sure. And John, listen, as a manager, I kind of curious about this because, you know, the game's so mental for players, but it seems to be mental for coaches too, because you got a lot of decisions to make as a manager. You know, in the back of your mind after a ball game, you know, you're going to say, you know, I thought I made the right decision,
yeah,
but maybe it wasn't the right decision, or maybe the player just didn't execute. I mean, that stuff's going through your mind constantly. Yeah. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's where players can make a manager look awfully, awfully good. When you got a team of people that know how to play, that know how to execute, I think to the point is when you ask somebody to do something and they're really not doing it, you're not using them to their fullest. You know, I mean, you know, when you're asking a power guy that doesn't know how to bunt, like we talked about before, to bunt, and you're asking about a guy that strikes out a lot to hit and run, you know, you're asking him to do things he's really not capable of doing. Either you work on these things to make him better, or don't ask him to do them. And we've all been in that position. I mean, it's called overmanaging. You know, you try to be aggressive, and sometimes when you try to be too aggressive, you overmanage, and you know, you push the envelope too much, and your thinking is to stay aggressive, but there, you know, sometimes when you try to be aggressive, you actually put yourself in a bind. So, you know, that's where coaches come in. You know, I mean, you know, there's some coaches that are conservative, some managers are conservative, and there's other ones, you know. I mean, Lou was always, he was always on the attack, you know.
He's like fearless.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, he, you know, the thing about somebody like Lou is, he could live with making a mistake. You know, I mean, he was looking out, you know, you tried something, it didn't work, you know, that's all right, Lou, you know, and then, you know, you get a less experienced guy and you do it like, what's this dummy doing, you know, but that's when you got a, you know, guy with experience like that, he can do what he wants to do.
Sure. Hey, John, this has been awesome. We're coming into the end, and I want to finish with this part because you were a third base coach in the big leagues. That's kind of changing a little bit. You know, I know here in Chicago, I've seen some players that, you know, kind of blow off the third base coach and don't even listen to what he's doing. But it's an important role still. Talk about some of the things that are important to being a third base coach and what your responsibility is.
Third base coach is all about situations. And when I used to go over base running in spring training, I tried to get the players to think like I'm thinking. I'm thinking about what inning it is. And what does that mean? That means you can make mistakes early part of the game and you still got plenty of innings to make up for it. A number of outs. I don't want to make the first out at third or home. It's a cardinal sin. It's not necessary. If you got to keep him at second base, even if it's a little conservative, he's still in scoring position. How many outs? What's the score? The score plays into it too. If we're winning 5-0, I can be extra aggressive, and if it doesn't work out, there's no problem. But if you're losing 4-0 late in the game and you make a bad decision, it could be the ball game. So you try to get the players thinking about situations like you think that you're thinking is when there's a hard base hit to left field and a runner on second base. To the left field, I've got to stop him sooner because it's a short throw from left field. The throw from center field and right field, I can actually bring him around third base and still stop him. He's got plenty of time to go back.
Mm-hmm.
So this goes into thinking and positioning. The toughest play for me as a third base coach was a ball down the right field line. If I didn't get far enough down the line towards home plate, I couldn't – my angle to read it wasn't as good. If I'm stuck on third base, I'm seeing a runner here, and I don't have quite the angle. If I'm down the third baseline, I see in my eye the runner, and I can also see the positioning of the guy getting ready to throw the ball. And, you know, I always try to know the arms in the outfield. You know, what guys can you run on? What can't you run on? You know, there's certain guys, it didn't make any difference. They didn't have very good arms. You're going to send them. Now, there's other guys, you wouldn't even think about challenging them because
yeah.
they had such strong arms.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to like to use one syllable. When my commands to the runner at second base, instead of talking a bunch of jibber jatter like, okay, come on, you're okay, plenty of room to buy, right? No, I say, okay, okay, okay. Every time I say okay, he can take one more. And my focus is, it wasn't so much his primary lead as a secondary lead. I want him coming off on the pitch. I want a momentum going towards third base. And someone was coming behind him. I'm not going to say, someone's behind you, watch out. I'm going to say hold. Hold means you take one step back. You're going back a little bit, being a little conservative, because the fielder is coming up behind you, and two outs and a close score. I would tell them, don't look for me. I'm sitting. You're going all the way on a base hit. I'm gonna put a positive right into his mind.
Nice.
A lot of the best secondary leads I have ever seen have been slow runners and excellent secondary leads. Then you have other guys that could fly, that they were always getting jockeyed back, and your momentum's going back to second base, and the pitcher's throwing the ball. I would rather have a conservative lead and then come off on the pitch.
Nice.
And so, like I said, it's a very difficult job to coach third base. And I would say I was always on the aggressive when I did it. And I think one of the toughest things is if you get a runner thrown out to the inning before, and all of a sudden you're in the same situation the next inning, especially late in the game, that's a lot of pressure, but that's part of the game. I loved it. And, coaching third base was a great challenge. And I tell you what, if you ever want to get into the game, that's the coaching position you want to be, because you're right in the middle of it.
Well, I got to believe, I mean, there's so much going on. You got to get signs from the manager. You know, you got to think ahead. I mean, there's so many things. You're moving guys. You're constantly running. It seems like you're constantly moving. And that kind of comes to my last question here, John. And that is, when you got multiple runners, how
yes.
you're dealing with the multiple
yes.
runners.
Yes. Yeah. That's a great point, Pete. What I try to do is I send the first runner and I'm going behind him to get out of his view And I always used, Cal Ripken Sr. told me this, my first year coaching in the big leagues in 1986, I had a runner, a couple runners run through me, and I had stop sign up, you know, and it, you know, you, and they make it, you kind of look foolish sometimes. So I just asked him, I said, how you handle that, Rip? And he says, well, first of all, you're the boss. And he says, what I used to always do, and he says, I would, when I threw my hands up, I wanted the person in the upper deck to see my hands. I stuck them up as high as I could. And what I used to always do, I gave verbal signs too. I would yell out, stop, along with putting my hands up. So I'm telling them with my hands. I'm also telling them with my mouth, and I'm screaming at them. But back to that play, I release the first runner, and then I go to the next runner, and I'm pointing towards third base and making sure he sees me. And sometimes, I mean, it's bang, bang. I mean, the first runner doesn't read the ball correctly, and you've got to release him sometimes because they're both there, and you got to take a chance. Just go ahead and send him. And it happened right before in spring training, two runners like that Dale Barra thing with Carlton Fisk that one time when they both got thrown out at home plate. And you can see how that happens when the runners get so close together, because the secondary runner, you've got to read the runner in front of you. It doesn't make any difference if you read the ball better than the guy in front of you. If the guy in front of you doesn't read, it doesn't do any good if you read it. You got to make sure he reacts or it doesn't do you any good. I mean, if I'm running all the way and I've done my, you know, I've read the ball and this and the guy in front of me got a poor start. I'm in no man's land, so I've got to let him, you know, do his thing before I can do mine.
John, fantastic. Love it. And folks on Facebook Live, sorry we weren't able to get to all your questions. We actually had a lot of questions. And what we're going to do, we're going to bring John back to the show because this has been outstanding. John, can't thank you enough, man. I know there's a lot going on right now. This was awesome. Really loved having you on the show.
Well, be safe, Pete. Like I said, these are times, but we'll get by this.
We will. I believe it also. And folks, that's John McLaren. I'm Pete Caliendo. I want to thank both of our lineup media group, our hosts that host the podcast. But I also want to thank all our listeners in the U.S. around the world for joining us on Facebook, YouTube, and in the future on the podcast. If it wasn't for our listeners, we wouldn't have a show. So thank you very much. Continue to spread the show around the world. We want to get the show out as much as possible. We're starting to grow more and more. Again, thanks to John McLaren, our producer, Brian Kroc, the lineup media group. I'm Pete Caliendo. He's John McLaren. Have a great day. We'll see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.